and welcome to another episode of The Micro Moment, the show that brings you down to the microscopic level to view the world just a little bit differently. I'm Tess.
And I'm John.
And today we will discuss another injustice in science. This one is all about girl power. Do you know why, John?
Why is that, Tess?
Because today we are talking about the microbe moment of one of the greatest female microbiologists, Esther Ledenberg.
Oh yeah, isn't her birthday pretty soon?
Yeah, her birthday is on December 18th. She was born in 1922, making her 98 this year.
But before we jump into the show, we'd like to wish a happy birthday to a few other great microbiologists that celebrate their birthdays in December.
First up, Franny Hess, another powerful female microbiologist, was born on December 1st, 1934.
We also have Louis Pasteur, one of the great fathers of microbiology, that celebrates his 139th birthday this year on December 27th.
The other father of microbiology, Robert Koch, is also a December baby. You can celebrate his 177th birthday with him on December 11th. That's so hard to say. 177th.
It doesn't really sound natural, does it?
No, it's a tough one.
We also have Abigail A. Slayers, who was born on December 24th. She is best known for her work on antibiotic resistance.
And finally, we have Gladys Stick, who shares the same birthday with Esther Ledenberg on December 18th, although she was born in 1881.
Gladys was best known for developing a vaccine for scarlet fever.
Wow, that's a lot of birthdays.
What was that, five, four, five? That is a lot of birthdays.
Yeah, but... and actually both of our mothers share a have a birthday in December.
Yeah, exactly. I guess December is the month for being born.
Powerful female figures! Anyways, you want to jump into the life of Esther Ledenberg?
Let's do it.
Do you know very much about her?
I don't really know anything about her.
Yeah, that is the problem. So let me educate you on the life of Esther Ledenberg. So she was born, as we said, on December 18th, 1922, as Esther Miriam Ledenberg. She was the oldest of two children, and her father was David Zimmer, and her mother was Pauline Geller Zimmer. So both of her parents were immigrants from Bukowina. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but it is what we now call the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We don't call it that now, but it was a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire of the time. So she grew up in the Bronx in an Orthodox Jewish community, and her father worked and ran a print shop. So we think of 1922. What do you usually think of?
I think of the Great Depression.
Well, it was before the Great Depression. Oh. So she was born in the time of speakeasies, Babe Ruth, immigrants of Ellis Island, but her childhood was indeed part of the Great Depression. And she grew up remembering a lunch of just bread topped with the juice of a squeezed tomato. Sounds super filling, huh?
Super.
Yeah.
Great nutrition.
You're so nutritious. Even from an early age, Esther was defying stereotypes. She learned Hebrew from her grandfather, which was very uncommon of the time. She went to Hunter College, where she pursued a degree in biochemistry, even though everyone told her to go pursue a degree of French or literature. Biochemistry was just too challenging for women. They couldn't do it.
I know I can't do it.
Biochem is hard. Good for her for making it through. So after she got her degree in biochemistry, she went to Stanford, which is like, what? She's so smart. And she got her master's degree in genetics in 1946. Did you even know that genetics could be a degree in 1946?
No, I mean, I'm trying to think. Like,
1953 was when DNA was discovered.
Okay, so when I think of 1946, I'm thinking, what, Mendelian genetics at that point?
Yeah, it's just like I never thought that genetics was even a degree that you could get before DNA was discovered. But yeah, she was before DNA was discovered. She was studying it. And so then she got her master's degree in, she met her first husband, Joshua Lederberg, which I thought when I first read this was super cute that he wrote her a letter and was like, "Hey girl, I really like your work on Neurospora. Maybe we should go out on a date." And she was like, "Okay." And then they got married 5 months later. Aw, it's so cute.
That is pretty cute.
Well, it gets cuter later, but anyways. So she, after her master's, she married Joshua, who got a professorship at the University of Wisconsin. And so she went and followed him and pursued her PhD under R.A. Brink. And her PhD, she discovered lambdaphage, which is kind of a big deal, right?
Right. So before we get into lambdaphage, let's back up a little bit and talk about what phages are. So phages are also known as bacteriophages. And what they are is they're viruses that infect specifically bacteria and archaea. The name means bacteria eater.
And you can either pronounce it phage or phage if you want to be bougie about it.
Yeah.
The bougie people say phage.
And each phage type usually infects one or only like a couple of bacteria, so they're particularly specific.
Yeah, which can be really nice sometimes for medical reasons.
Yeah, we'll touch upon that a little bit later in the podcast. But there are three basic types. For those that are tabletop players, we have icosahedral, which is the same as a 20-sided dice with a tail, and it looks like it has legs or a spider. There is an icosahedral without a tail, and one that is a filamentous, pretty much what it looks like a worm. They can either have RNA or DNA, and either single-stranded or double-stranded.
Like a virus.
Exactly. So, the lambdaphage. It is an icosahedral virus with a tail that infects E. coli. You usually see it penetrating the cell and injecting its DNA, but this one will interact with a pore on the E. coli where the DNA goes into the bacteria. And it has two methods of replication or infection. The cooler one is that it integrates its viral DNA into specific sites of the bacterial genome. There it lays dormant and the viral DNA replicates with the bacterial DNA, resulting in the viral DNA being in the bacterial clone. And it remains dormant until it's stimulated by some factor where the DNA comes out of the bacterial DNA and replicates, creating many viruses and lyse the bacterial cell. And this whole process is called lyogeny. And it lays dormant because it has a gene in its viral DNA that prevents it from replicating. And this stops when factors stimulate its replication, such as ultraviolet light.
Yeah, so it's like a stress, almost like a stress-induced factor.
Exactly.
It's like, hey, bro, I'm just going to like stick myself inside you, and we're just going to hang out. And then when you get stressed out, I'm going to piece the fuck out.
That's a perfect analogy for that. So then it produces this enzyme that breaks down the repressor, and then you get replication. Sometimes, though, a portion of this of the bacterial DNA is taken out with the viral DNA, turning into a transducing phage. This phage can transmit genes into other bacteria it infects. This is called lysogenic conversion, giving bacteria genes with specific functions that the bacteria normally do not have. An example of this is called the CTX phage.
CTX?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So this is a phage that is specific to Vibrio cholera.
Oh, our favorite.
Exactly.
We love cholera here, but don't get it. It's not fun. Not that I would know, but... I don't want to know. You don't want to know.
You don't want to know.
Love cholera. Don't get it.
And so what this CTX phage has is the cholera toxin, and it can infect cholera that doesn't have the toxin, and then it inserts the toxin into its genome, and therefore you get cholera that is pathogenic to people.
Oh, that's why CTX sounded familiar.
Yeah.
Pieces are coming together now.
Like I said, it has two life cycles. It also has a lytic cycle where it just foregoes inserting into the genome and just replicates and then lyses the cell.
Yeah, and prior to the discovery of lambdaphage, that's what they thought all bacteriophage was.
Yeah.
Was this lytic, just lysing the bacteria, never able to stay dormant and kind of bond with them a little.
So the basis of the lambdaphage is used for genetically modifying bacteria today. One of the ways, I should say. And there are like four different ways, but the ones I really know about is using a plasmid that has the viral DNA in it, and the virus itself you can modify. You can use the lambda genes to integrate a gene of interest into an area of the E. coli genome, or you can excise a gene from the genome. Usually this is use antibiotic resistance is a good way to select for it, where you would plate the transformed bacteria on an antibiotic plate. And if you see a colony, you would then take it and then sequence it to make sure that the gene of interest is either there or deleted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when Esther and Joshua discovered this, it was before they even knew DNA, before they even had sequencing, which just blows my mind.
I know, I can't really wrap my head around that.
Yeah, because today every answer is, then you sequence it.
Yeah.
And poof, answered. So I just think that is so, it's so crazy to think of these times before they had sequencing at their disposal as a tool to discover genetics, like, and this is before they even know what DNA looked like. Oh, it's amazing. And so I just want to close. Do you have anything else on lambdaphage?
No, that's pretty much it for lambdaphage.
I just want to close this discussion on lambdaphage by quoting their paper. So in Lederberg, 1952, because they were a power couple, they said in their paper, in addition to the progressive parasitic relationship that these studies have analyzed, many phage bacterium complexes persist in a more enduring symbiosis, lysogenicity. I just love that phrase, enduring symbiosis. It's so adorable.
Like enduring love.
Like enduring love. Until they decide that you're too stressed out, and then they're going to rip from your body and go infect someone else.
Make you explode.
So cute. All right, so we're now in 1952, still before DNA was discovered. And this is when Joshua and Esther discovered replica plating. And so this was another collaboration between Esther and Joshua. Now, a lot of people say that Joshua was kind of the guy with the big ideas, whereas Esther was the one that was able to put them into practice and actually make these ideas come to reality inside the lab. So, John, do you want to tell us a little bit about replica plating?
Yeah, so I actually never heard about replica plating before this, but after reading it, it's so simple but ingenious at the same time. So, like you said, it was first described by Esther Lederberg and Joshua Lederberg. It was a way to screen for a phenotype of an organism with specific characteristics. And so what you do is you start with a master plate that has, it has all those single colonies on it, plated, spotting all over the plate. Each colony is genetically similar. Each colony is derived from one bacteria, and all those bacteria in that colony are genetically similar. Next, you use a piece of sterile velvet on a block and you press it onto the master plate. And then you take that velvet and then you press it onto two new plates, the first being a general media plate and one with some sort of selection like antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a stamp or a plate stamp.
Exactly. And then a third plate is also used after the selection plate to make sure that the phenotype that you see isn't due to improper stamping.
Mm-hmm.
And by comparing the plates, you can tell the phenotype of the colony. Like I said, you can tell if the colony has antibiotic resistance. If it's not there on the antibiotic resistance plate, there you go. It doesn't have it. You can also use it can also be used for something called auxotrophy. Sorry. And this is when an organism can no longer make an organic compound. And you want to see if something like an essential gene has been deleted or knocked out, in which case the plate, which should grow all the colonies, has that organic compound, and the selective plate does not.
Right. So the velvet, if you think of velvet, it's smooth and it's soft, but it's not flat, right? So you got all these little inoculating loops, essentially, that when you stamp it in, it's going to pick up the bacteria without pressing too hard into the plate and then transfer it over to a new plate in the same exact orientation.
Right.
So the way that I've also seen this described by Rebecca Farrell, a professor of biology at Metropolitan State University of Denver, said that it's kind of like the difference between handwritten manuscripts and a printing press. And even though Joshua Lederberg's name comes first in this paper, everyone believes that Esther was the one who actually made this happen. Now, if you remember, Esther was a Great Depression child. She grew up with a father who worked in printing. So this kind of ingenuity of using and reusing material that's already at your disposal definitely seems like something that she could come up with.
Yeah, it's something in her family. It's part of her background.
Right. So I think, yeah, definitely an Esther discovery, not a Joshua. In 1956, the Society of Illinois Bacteriologists awarded the Pasteur Award to both Joshua and Esther for their identity of the fertility factor. Now, Joshua would also win a Nobel Prize for the fertility factor, where Esther did not. But what is the fertility factor, or F placid?
All right, let's talk about that a little bit. In a nutshell, the F plasmid is a way to transfer genetic material from one bacteria to another.
Bacterial sex.
Yes, but no. So, let's start with the F pilus. A pilus is a small tube-like extension of a bacteria or archaea. It's Latin for hair, and has different functions, such as it can be used for twitch movement, adherence to like walls, a receptor for viruses, and exchange of genetic material between two cells, which is also called bacterial conjugation. So the F pilus is also called the sex pili, like you said before, because we're transferring genetic material from one to another. So this goes into the fertility factor, or the F sex factor of the F plasmid, allowing for genes to be transferred from one bacterium carrying the factor to another that doesn't have these genes. Those that do have the F factor are called F positive or male, and those that do not are F minus or female. So the F plus bacterium will attach to an F minus through the pilus and transfer this genetic material through the pilus, transforming the female bacteria to a male. And now that new male can now create the F pilus, has genetic material, and transfer it to another bacteria. So it, like I said, it transfers genes that are that can be things like antibiotic resistance or being able to create more metabolites or different metabolites that it hadn't previously been able to.
Interesting. Yeah, so this is what Joshua Lettenberg won the Nobel Prize for in 1958. He shared the prize with George Beadle and Edward Todhem, but not with Esther.
That's rude.
So rude. Again, a quote from Rebecca Farrell says that it's this group of four people, referring to Beadle, Todhem, and Lettenberg, who worked on things. And the three guys get the prize, and she gets to put on gloves and a long gown and watch. How rude.
That's infuriating if you think about it.
You know what's even more infuriating?
What?
He didn't even acknowledge her.
What?
Yeah. So she had to go and sit down and watch these three men get the Nobel Prize. And they didn't even say, thank you, Esther. He was just like, yeah, I got a wife.
Man, even actors can pull that off when they give their thanks speeches during the Oscars? Oscars, yeah.
Yeah. So I just think that is, like, if you ever did that to me, yep. That relationship over.
Done.
Which is not far from what Esther did. So although she never attributes the Nobel Prize slighting her as a reason for divorcing Joshua, the two did get a divorce in 1966. It was not an easy time for Esther after she divorced Joshua. A lot of people of the time would just say, well, you're only significant because you're married to that guy over there. You don't actually have any intelligence.
So they wouldn't even give her the time of day?
Yeah, so she never got a professorship worth tenure track position. The only reason she got a faculty position, it was in the 1959, she and a couple other females went to Stanford and were like, excuse me, why are there no females working here? And they're like, because we don't like women. And they're like, but maybe you should. And then they gave them some faculty position. So she got one in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. And then after she got divorced from Joshua, they didn't want to keep her around. So she struggled a lot trying to keep a job. And then 1974, they even changed her title from a senior scientist to an adjunct professor, which is like, oh, it's a gut shot.
Yeah, you couldn't even be a full professor. You had to be an adjunct professor.
After like 15 years and all of the major discoveries that she had, she never was able to get a tenure track position. And so in 1976, she became the director of Stanford's Plasmid Reference Center, where she worked until 1985, where she retired. So if you look at, she does have a Google Scholar page, and there are over 20 papers in which she is an author on. And if you include conferences and posters and talks and everything, there are over 50 pieces of work that belong to her and her research. So after her divorce, she stayed single for a fairly long time. And she really loved medieval and Renaissance and Baroque music. For those of you who don't know, Baroque music includes things like Johann Sebastian Bach and George Frederick Handel. Remember when we went to his house?
Oh, yeah.
That was interesting. He shared a house with Jimi Hendrix.
And Jimi Hendrix once said that he swore he saw his ghost.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool museum. You should go to it. It's in London somewhere.
Yeah, it took us a little while to find it.
Yeah, it was kind of hard, but it was a cute little museum. And then, of course, Johann Pachelbel, who does that wedding song that everyone does. They walk down the aisle too. You know, that wedding song.
That one.
Yeah. So she really loved this music, and she found someone who also loved this music, Matthew Simon. And so whereas Joshua Lettenberg was always kind of pushing Esther to the side and be like, you're not significant, Matthew Simon was always putting Esther on a pedestal. And when she died on November 11th, 2006, he dedicated the majority of his waking hours from that point on creating a memorial website for Esther Lettenberg with the sole purpose of trying to tell everybody how great she was and how significant of a scientist she was.
If that isn't love, I don't know what is.
Aw, it's so cute. At any rate, that is Esther's life. She died at 83 years old from pneumonia and congestive heart failure. And then a couple of fun facts, I guess, about her is she picked up the recorder. Did you ever play the recorder growing up?
I think elementary school, I had a couple of years of trying to quote-unquote play the recorder.
Yeah, it's a kind of a terrible instrument.
Yeah.
But she fell in love with it and thought that it was great. So, you know, to each their own. Another fun fact about Esther is when she was pursuing her master's, she got a scholarship, but she was still too poor, as we all are in academia, to support herself. So she became a TA, a teaching assistant, which most of us do. But she also had to go a couple steps further. She reported to do her landlady's laundry so that she didn't have to pay rent, so that she could live, she could have a roof over her head, which, gross.
Yeah.
I don't want to do anyone else's laundry.
Yeah, I have to give her credit for working that hard.
Yeah, she worked very hard. And then finally, she reports having to have eaten frog legs while she was really poor, but not like bougie frog legs. Like, she would go into the dissection rooms in laboratories at the university after they dissected the frogs, take the legs, and then cook those. Which I'm not really sure, because, like, when I dissected a frog, it was kind of full of formaldehyde.
So, yeah, in either case, don't take frog legs from an anatomy class and try to eat them.
My guess is they didn't have formaldehyde at that point.
No, they must have been fresh.
Yeah. So, yep, that's all I have on Esther Lettenberg. I'm pretty sure she should have gotten a Nobel Prize. She definitely had a number of micro moments that I am really happy that I got to share with everybody.
Yeah, it was great hearing about her.
So do you have anything else you want to add about phage?
Yeah, I'd like to talk a second about phage therapy.
Ooh, so, what's that?
So it's a potential new therapy for bacterial infections. This uses phages, like I said, to treat bacteria rather than antibiotics. Potentially useful for multi-drug resistant bacteria. And as we stated earlier, it's good because these phages are particularly specific to very select few bacteria, so you don't run the risk of decimating, say, like, if we're treating your gut, you wouldn't be decimating your microbiome.
Right, so they're a lot more specific. When you take an antibiotic, it just wipes out everything that might be sensitive to that antibiotic, not just the bad bacteria.
Exactly. And as of right now, I am not aware of any FDA-approved phage therapies, but there are biotech companies out there trying to produce a phage therapy. There's one called Adaptive Phage Therapeutics, and they've created like a phage bank, and it has like over 150 different phages.
Wow, that's a lot of phages.
And these, like we said, these phages attack specific targeted bacteria. And in November of this year, the FDA had granted them expanded access for investigational new drug applications. This is, for instance, for instances outside clinical trials for people with serious or life-threatening conditions. And this is for particularly COVID patients with secondary infections with carbapenem-resistant A. Barahmani, which can cause pneumonia or septicemia. And this is happening in Rio Grande Valley of Texas. And as of right now, I don't know the outcomes because this is so new.
Well, yeah, I think it will probably take a couple months before we know too much more.
But I just found that, you know, this new treatment really cool to hear about.
Yeah, I think phage therapy is definitely a blossoming field right now that has a lot of great hope, I guess, for the future.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear the outcome of this, and I'm really excited.
Yeah, if we hear about it, we'll let you know. So, Microbial Nation, that is the end of our show. We'd like to thank you so, so much for listening. We hope you now have some fun facts to present at your next Zoom meeting.
If you've enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and share with a friend.
And as always, you can find us at microbigals.com. That's microbigals.com.
You can also send us some feedback at microbigals@gmail.com or rate us on iTunes.
Come chat with us at Twitter at microbigals.
Or check out some pictures of our adorable puppy on Instagram at microbigals.
We hope you enjoyed listening, and we hope you and your microbes stay powerful.
Bye.
Bye.